Hi guys, I'm Dana Al-Hanbali and this is Something to Consider. Today we welcome the brilliant and often misunderstood Sarah Al-Agroubi, a multidisciplinary artist, researcher, educator, and podcaster whose work seeks to explore the very essence of humanity. Through her art and academic pursuits, Sarah explores the intricate relationships between culture, identity, and society, offering profound insights into what shapes us as individuals and communities. Her creative journey spans regions and disciplines, making her a truly unique voice in today's cultural zeitgeist. Sarah has founded impactful initiatives like the Letters Project, a platform amplifying anonymous voices to reflect the socio-cultural fabric of the Arab world, and she hosts the Native Informant podcast, where she sparks important conversations around cultural identity and post-colonial discourse. Her work reflects the ever-evolving social attitudes and creative expressions of the time, pushing boundaries to challenge societal norms, confront social tensions, and offer insights into the human experience. In this conversation, we'll delve into how her art and ideas uncover the deeper layers of societal constructs, explore the complexities of belonging, and shine a light on personal and collective stories that define our place in the world. Sarah, welcome to the show and thank you for being here.
Hi, Dana. Thank you for having me.
Hey, absolutely. It's such a pleasure to have you because I've known you for so long.
I know. We're going to get into that.
I know. We are going to get into that. And I just feel like, you know, it's one thing to know someone over a long period of time because I'm a true believer that relationships have a tendency to evolve.
Of course.
But what I've appreciated about our relationship is I feel like I've had a front row seat to your evolution as a woman, as a creative, as an educator, and as someone who's actively contributing to kind of the world that we are collectively forming.
Oh, thanks so much, Dana.
I feel very lucky to do that.
I appreciate it. Thank you for saying that. As of you as well.
Happy to. Thank you. Sarah, I usually like to start the conversation with you laying the foundation of your own background. So if I were to ask you, what about the context of your life has set the stage, can potentially set the stage for this conversation? What do you want our audience to know about you before we move into the conversation?
I think it would probably go down deep into like the crevasse of my personal identities in that I'm constantly misunderstood. I'm constantly being painted in a light that I don't necessarily exist. And I think a lot of it stems from insecurities or aspects of that that can be showcased and shaped in the way that people think that I'm supposed to be as a person. So I would think hopefully they would get an interesting viewfinder into who I am as a person from someone who actually knows me very well, which I think is a very rare and special experience. So that's what I hope for.
Brilliant. Can you give us a little bit about your background? Where are you from?
So I'm half Emirati, half Syrian. It was probably one of the first identity markers that I announced myself with, as you know, from knowing me for a very long time. I speak and breathe duality as a concept and a construct that is interwoven into the fabric of all of my practices, whether it's research, writing, et cetera, et cetera. I am known to be quite disagreeable and contrarian and rebellious and a naysayer for many things, and I follow the beat of my own drum. And I'm somebody that was born in Belgium and was brought up in many different countries due to the fact that my father was a diplomat. And I moved back to the UAE quite late in life and formulated an understanding of Arab identity, which I like to kind of call as the sort of native outsider or the native informant, which is the title of my podcast. So I think that's probably me in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. That's a good overview.
There you go. I've spent a lifetime trying to cop it.
Perfect. I have a question, though. You use the term disagreeable. Mm-hmm. And I understand that maybe that does frame a lot of the responses that you provoke when it comes to your content. Mm-hmm. But why did you choose that word?
Because I think that after doing a lot of research in the sort of intersexual dynamics between men and women and understanding the frameworks from which we depart from, just from like human evolution, psychology, understanding people's pathology, a lot of the times People would like to categorize me as a sort of person that harbors a lot of masculine energy or a lot of traits that one would associate with a man, mainly that I compartmentalize a lot of things whenever I think. I tend to lead more rationally and logically in terms of my thinking rather than emotionally. I tend to think of things in quite black and white rather than gray, even though I am a representation of the gray because I am, both in one foot in and one foot out. So I think it's balancing that or harmonizing that. And I think that the idea that I stand up for what I believe in, I don't shy away from confrontation. What I say is what I mean, and what I mean is what I say. And I think that people maybe have a hard time digesting that from a woman because it tends to be framed as bossy or bitchy or problematic when it can be considered strong and assertive and
powerful.
Powerful. But so I tend to frame it from those perspectives.
Okay, fair enough. Recently, I've noticed in your content that you've spoken about moments in your life that have changed everything. And what I mean by that is circumstances, instances, and people that have changed you. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what was the most profound turning point for you, and how did it reshape the way that you see yourself and the world around you?
That's a difficult question to ask because it's multifaceted for me. I think it's not necessarily a person, but it's an archetype. It's a type of person. And I think because I was raised in an environment that I constantly was misunderstood, I was always trying to cater to other people's needs and expectations. And I tended to gravitate a lot of people that was considered under the umbrella narcissistic or quite self-serving or quite self-indulgent. And I started to notice a pattern of behavior, whether that's in relationships, whether that's in family, whether that's in friends, whether that's in a professional setting. And I was like, why am I doing this? And with therapy, with reading up a lot of understanding people's pathology and the way that they carry themselves, I understood a lot of it was my responsibility to having to distance myself away from those people because I was feeding into that supply that they were needing. And so I tend to now really focus on driving myself away from people that have that, I guess, shell of that archetype or have nuances of that archetype. And I push myself towards people that are more like-minded in the way that they give back to the community. Because people like to think if you are assertive and disagreeable and all this, then you're very selfish and you're very self-serving. But I would consider myself very, very selfless. I do things for other people all the time, and I give up parts of myself that I could never get back for other people. And I think that I've reached a point in my life now where I'm not being selfish, but I'm allowing myself the privileges of indulging in what is my right that I never knew that I had before, which was that, no, you have to be giving. You have to provide safe spaces for other people. You have to, indulge other people's comfort levels, even if it's at your own expense. And now I'm in a position where I no longer will do that. And people can claim that that's selfish, or they might think that that's self-serving. It's like, well, no, actually, that's what people should do. They should have clear and healthy boundaries between them and other people. So just to kind of round out your question, for me, it's really never been about a specific person. It's been about an archetype.
That being said, though, do you feel like the circumstances in your life, because it's something that I very much relate to, you're not someone who's gotten married yet. Mm-hmm. You are incredibly educated. You are an entrepreneur in your own right. You're an artist. So you fit a specific archetype. Do you feel like this sort of internal reflection comes as a result of that type of a lifestyle? And is that something a little more recent, or do you feel like that's something you've always had?
I think when you examine yourself through a certain lens, whether it's a societal lens or a familial lens from your parents or just, from friends and whatnot, you start to call into question these things like, am I single because I am too independent, too ambitious? Are those reasons why I haven't been able to foster strong foundations with partners and in a romantic setting? And I think both yes and no, I think two truths can exist simultaneously, because it's a give and take, right? It's reciprocal. Whatever you throw out as an action, you will have a reaction to that. So for me, I think it's both part and parcel of the same formula, that if you are a person who is successful, independent, educated, worldly, self, like well-read, well-versed, well-traveled, all of those things, that you give off this impression that you are resolved and therefore you don't need a partner to come in because mm-hmm. you have already completed that hyper-independence. But I think if you think that way, then you think that you're the problem, when in actual fact, you just haven't met the right person that is able to share in that sort of interdependent dynamic. And is that rare? Yes. And so you won't have maybe this opportunity to meet 20,000 people that are like-minded individuals. I mean, they do say something ridiculous, like 2% of the world's population is self-aware or has the ability to even post-rationalize. So if you're a person that carries yourself as someone who self-reflects and post-rationalizes and is critically thinking and calling into question things, finding a partner that's willing to share in that likeness is really, really rare. So I think it's both, you know, it's two sides of the same coin.
Your work seeks to uncover the essence of humanity. And mm-hmm. please feel free to kind of counter that if I've mm-hmm. summed it up incorrectly, but I see it as the essence of humanity because you're exploring culture, you're exploring identity, and you're looking at it through the lens of how society has framed it. Mm-hmm. How do you find that these concepts led you to delve into them so deeply in the research and the art that you do?
I think that art practice in general is micro forms of social activism that reflect a deep curiosity of who you are and how you move through this world. Mm. And so I am constantly rewriting and adding to this thesis statement that is my life. So of course, my practice is going to extend itself out into many different vertices, into many different trajectories, into many different verticals where, you know, I'm going to research this idea of like, you know, half Emirati identity, for example. It's this notion of duality, but then that duality and uncovering and unmasking is also seen in the way in which I carve out in my paintings, but then it's also seen in sort of narratives and conversations that I have trying to help marginalized and underrepresented groups. It's always trying to find a midpoint or an intersection between two opposing thoughts and theories. And so, yes, it is it's an understanding of humanity, but it's also an understanding of self, because I am, privileged enough to live in a country that is still so young mm-hmm. that the understanding towards its people and refining its relationship towards the notion of cultural rootedness and then cultural duality or cultural intersection is something that still has yet to be explored. So why not take the opportunity to really dive in head deep before you know how to swim? And that, I think, is why this type of research is so important, especially when it comes to my research on half Emirati. I mean, I cannot tell you how many messages I receive in the DMs being like, I'm half Emirati too. I've never seen myself reflected in a lot of this research. This is amazing. I cannot wait for the research to be published. And I was like, that's why I do it, because I want people that in the next generation or people who have dealt with that sort of duality, even if they're not half Emirati per se, but half Kuwaiti or half Saudi, they can see fragments of themselves within the literature and the findings. And it's based on factual evidence that's being presented. It's not just a thought or an idea that's merely a hypothetical. It's now something that's tangible and real.
Would you say, though, that this entire pursuit could be framed as a pursuit towards more of a sense of belonging?
Absolutely. But I think it's a belonging on your terms. Mm. And I think that for a long time, I try to fit myself into notions of belonging that other people have carved out for me. And I use the word carving, even though I carve in my paintings as well. But and part of my, I guess, artist statement is carving out places for personal contemplation, which is very true. But I think that now it's like, if you're setting a standard for a normal, you have to be willing to self-annihilate and sacrifice yourself and be this kind of martyr of sorts to create a new normal. Mm. And I had a really honest conversation with myself through the series of cancel culture, through the series of the experiences that I've gone through, that if it means I have to be a social martyr, then so be it. Because it takes a very particular type of personality to be able to do that. You have to have a thick skin and can tolerate this type of interaction with the world.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you frame it like that, because I was just talking to someone about this exact topic. And I feel like such a large part of change that a lot of people don't understand is that they need to be prepared. They need to understand that, one, there is sacrifice in it. Mm-hmm. And taking on that sacrifice is a conscious choice that you make. Mm-hmm. And it comes with, I don't want to say consequences, but it comes with circumstances that are going to change the way that you're living. It comes with leaving behind that comfort zone. Mm-hmm. In your work, you examine what shapes us as individuals as well as communities. Mm-hmm. What have you found to be some universal truths about human nature that you feel like you've uncovered? Truths that maybe transcend culture or societal boundaries?
Unfortunately, a lot of the things that I've uncovered that are universally recognized is that people are flawed and that people are inherently selfish beings. Mm. And I think that, which is unfortunate, because when I look at the commonalities between certain groups of people that, and I've said this in other podcasts on multiple occasions, but I say the way that we exist and the way that we operate in this world is we walk a very fine line between order and chaos. Mm. And so people are often dipping their toes into order and in chaos. And sometimes you steer far left and sometimes you steer far right. But the idea of walking that fine line is to have a balance and to know what is true and what is just, and really sits at the underbelly of what we understand as the human existence and human consciousness. But because we live in a world where people would rather go far right or rather left with this idea of order and chaos, that it reminds me of that flaw that I spoke about 5 seconds ago. So I think it's unfortunate that that's the case. The beauty of it as well is that, you know, I find that people are yearning for a sense of belonging. I think when we talk about the three things that we need in society is food, shelter, and social inclusion. So people want to have a sense of belonging. They want to be included. They want to have a sense of community. And what I found is happening now is that there's this drive towards a Western-centric narrative, which is of individualism and to operate as an individual and to not care for community and collective consciousness. And that's something that I find deeply troubling, mm-hmm. because the beauty that we're witnessing, whether it's in the people of Beirut or the people of Gaza, or the people of Syria, or the people of Sudan, or the people of Congo, all around the global South in general, is this collective consciousness of collectivism. Mm. That's what people are operating, this community of people building relationships around family, tribes, indigeneity, all of those things. And so that's what I hope is being pushed as this idea that, no, we're rejecting individualism and going towards collectivism.
I truly hope that too. That being said, social constructs seem to shift in interesting ways depending on the cultural lens you look at it through. Mm-hmm. How do you feel like these shifts play out in our region amongst Arabs compared to Western context? And how do you feel like they contribute to shaping identity?
Can you give me an example so I can contextualize it?
So, for example, building on this idea of collectivism versus individualism, mm-hmm. we are now moving into this idea where a lot of women are rejecting this idea of being these individualistic, independent women that isolate themselves from the collective and the community, mm-hmm. in pursuit of things that are external. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's interesting is because that's something that's very much been embedded into our upbringing over the past, I would say, 30 years. Right now, we're seeing a slight shift towards this idea of, I want to go back to what makes us us, mm-hmm. In terms of our collective nature as a community. I believe that I do have a role to play in my society that is not bound to or limited to what my context is asking for me. It feels like it's something a lot more innate.
So it's interesting that you say this, because I remember having a conversation with someone about the understanding of the occupation of space. Mm-hmm. And they made this kind of argument that men dominate public spaces and women tend to dominate private spaces in the Arab world. What they mean by public spaces is that the man is the classic breadwinner. He's the one who's going out in the world, you know, making ends meet and then coming back and providing for the family. And the woman is kind of dominating the way in which we understand the home and the kitchen and raising kids and creating and being more of the caregiver. And what I found was there was this rejection, as you speak of women should no longer dominate private spaces and move towards these public spaces. And that in order to move into this public space, you have to sacrifice the private space. And when I spoke about this idea of self-annihilation, it's this idea that, well, women are complex creatures. We can balance we're multidimensional beings. So this idea of us rejecting one to have another is something that's so foreign for us. Like if we really want to go back into stereotypical lens, like we are triple threats. We can, you know, cook, clean and have like, you know, and work and be in time for like for dinner, you know, and have and make sure that our husbands, you know, are happy with all of these like stereotypical things that they want to associate with women. But what I find is that there is beauty in that because to reject the private space is to reject our mothers and mm-hmm. our grandmothers and our great-grandmothers and the legacies that we've come from. And I think women are kind of going back to that because that is what we are innately built to do. Mm-hmm. Not to say that we cannot go into the public spaces and work and persevere and be independent and whatnot, but the shift towards that, if we talk about it from a Western-centric lens, for example, mm-hmm. women started working because the men went to war and they died, and then they were forced to move into that.
Correct.
So you abandoning that space is just is just admitting and succumbing to the male gaze. Mm. You are succumbing to the Western gaze. You are succumbing to a misogynistic lens of what a woman should be mm-hmm. in order to be considered palatable to society or palatable to the masses. And so a lot of the times when we talk about feminism or a lot of the times when we talk about the different waves of feminism, it realistically is just us pandering to the male gaze and working out ways to understand and tolerate misogyny or internalized misogyny that suits a overarching global narrative, mm-hmm. which is not something that we assign ourselves as people from the global South or people who come from indigenous cultures. That's just not part of our fabric. So when we're having these conversations about, yes, as a woman, we should be able to be independent and not have to rely on a man and, you know, get married and have not get married and not have children and be these kind of like hashtag boss bitches, you are rejecting the very essence of you through the lens of masculinity. And then you are condemning yourself for having that narrative and then blaming the masculine energy for imposing that on you. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's almost like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Mm-hmm. So I think women trying to fight in the West, and this is something that I said on my own podcast, this idea of when we talk about patriarchal structures, us from the Arab lens, when we talk about patriarchy, we don't talk about it as equality when it comes to financial benefits for both genders. We don't talk about it from that lens. We don't talk about it, you know, equality in the workplace or having equality of opportunity. That's not what our patriarchy or the patriarchal belief system that we're addressing is trying to uncover. Mm-hmm. We're talking about patriarchal belief systems that are intertwined in cultural narratives that are embedded in a masculine lens of what religion should be, and then using it to cushion a very specific ideology. Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to fight against. We're not trying to fight against like, oh, he gets £50,000, I should get £50,000 too. That is beyond something that we're interested in. So I find that the influence or the influx of Western narratives that are being imposed on Arab narratives is causing a disservice because people are, they're drinking the Kool-Aid. And I can be one to put my hands up and say that I drank the Kool-Aid for a very long period of time.
I think we all did.
But recognizing and course correcting is something that I think is very important. And so using our ability to critically think and go, yeah, that doesn't reside with me. No, thank you. You can have that back. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where I'm at.
I agree. And what I find interesting is that if we go back to this idea of reframing, so much of that definition, and this idea of having to make a choice is something that is pushed through Western narratives and almost imposed upon us, mm-hmm. when in reality, it's not about, they're not pushing for this idea of us being able and being empowered to make a choice. They are saying there is a right choice and there is a wrong choice. Mm-hmm. And that's what I find so interesting about this. And I feel like, to your point, the more introspective you get and the more you open yourself up to being critical, mm-hmm. and engaging, mm-hmm. in more of a discourse around this, the more it empowers you to kind of discover what is right for you versus what society says is right for you in this era, in this decade, in the context of wherever it is that you live.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that the nature, just to put on your point, isn't that the nature of identity politics? Mm. That if you are not with us, you're against us.
100%.
If you are not for this, you are, if you are not a friend, you are foe.
100%.
And I think that a lot of these discussions, I used to constantly have these discussions with friends through the lens of identity politics or talking about intersectionality, when in actual fact, reframing it outside of a Western-centric lens has been the best thing to do, that it's no longer identity politics. I think that that can be quite problematic at times. I think that carving out your own lens and knowing how you depart in that conversation and contextualizing it is the core essence of getting to the understanding of what we actually stand for and where our commonalities exist. But if we constantly use the West to frame everything
and approve,
then it's a never-ending vicious cycle.
And it's a losing game, mm-hmm. I think, at the end of the day. And that's what we're seeing now. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about 2020 because I feel like 2020 was the year that, the year where a lot of courses changed, mm-hmm. my own included. This era has seen a dramatic shift in social attitudes and creative expressions. And mm-hmm. we've seen that even with how vocal this new generation has been to a variety of different conversations. From your perspective, what do you think defines this period that we are in right now? And how has it influenced narratives that we tell about ourselves?
I think we are living in the age of truth, mm-hmm. which is trying to come out of the webs of lies that we see on social media that has been framed under the umbrella of social contagions. Mm. So when we kind of post 2020, we had this influx of so many different narratives and ideologies that were coming our way on many different scales, which is the way in which we understand, for example, identity, gender, society, culture, feminism, all of these different things. And I think what has happened is we have allowed for propaganda and mass media to influence the way in which we are being indoctrinated, but it's been blatant. It's been like really in your face. And I think that when you are having, when you are having the other dictate who you should be and how you should behave and what you should believe in and what your thoughts are and what your ideologies are, you get lost in the source and you don't understand how to move you don't really understand what you stand for. And I've said this on multiple occasions, if you stand for nothing, you fall for anything. Mm. And I think that one of those truths of how 2020 has shaped us is that we've started to see the undercurrent of truth and perseverance rise up to the top and shatter that ceiling shatter that glass of what we thought was true and what we thought was real and what we thought we should believe in. And I think it's been a beautiful war between good and evil, actual evil versus good. Mm. And I think for a long time, it was so subtle and so nuanced that we didn't even see it. But now that everything is blatant and in our face about how we understand society, how we understand our identity as Arabs, whether we're framed through the lens of like terrorism or the lens of being barbaric or the lens of being
oppressed
or a primitive or, you know, any of those things. We fought against that because the truth of the undercurrent is riding that overcurrent so unapologetically and so viciously with nothing but a clear goal in mind that I'm here for it. I'm so excited for it. But it's taken a couple of years because, you know, 2020 was like half a decade ago. So,
oh my God. Yeah. I love how you framed the beauty behind it. But I think one of the things that keeps me up at night is I feel like there's a level of trust that has been broken. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, how do you think this has changed the way that we interact with each other as individuals? Because if I'm being honest, this is also the wave of us not being able to tolerate a lot of things, a lot of things, but also each other. Mm-hmm. So this idea of going from you should accept everything and everything, which I don't necessarily agree with. Mm-hmm. We've come to a stage where because trust has been broken, it's almost a little bit, we're in that aggressive stage where we're not, in some cases, we're not even able to hear each other out. Mm. So I'm curious, how do you think this has changed the dynamic of how we interact with each other?
I think what's interesting about just us having conversations in general, whether it's like Arab to Arab or Arab to somebody from the West or whatnot, is that we have grown a much larger capacity to understand the human condition. Mm-hmm. But growing that larger capacity or having that larger capacity has allowed us to really set the tone of what we tolerate, as you said. Because we have a more expansive understanding of what we do or don't tolerate, we are able to frame conversations in a much better way. Mm. The question is right now is that, do I have the capacity to be patient? Mm. Do I have the capacity to be understanding that might jeopardize my position in this conversation? Mm. And that, I think, is where the tolerance comes into place. Because being completely tolerant is that you do have the capacity for these types of expansive conversations. But I think now that tolerance has that fuse is so short that now it's like, I can't be bothered. Like, yeah, leave me alone. I can't be bothered to have this discussion. It's very black and white. Because when you have an expansive understanding of what you tolerate, you feel you have more room to maneuver that space, that in order for you to feel comfortable in your position, you have to either go black or white. You cannot go gray. And so that's when that short fuse circuits. Like, mm-hmm. it becomes a test of patience, a real test of sabr. Mm. And I think that as Arabs, as Muslims, that is one of our greatest tests. If you have sabr, if you have the ability to be compassionate and empathetic, then you can get through any conversations, however wild and contrarian and outlandish they may be. You can have these conversations with somebody that is like a completely primitive, disrespectful, ignorant, chauvinistic, whatever person that you're talking to. You'll be able to keep calm, sit in your thoughts, and be able to answer back when you need to. But whether we have the patience for it is the biggest test that we have.
Mm, I love that. And I just want to kind of, there's an underlying message here that with that patience comes two things, a need for empathy, but also a requirement of vulnerability, mm-hmm. which is very difficult in a space where we have lost trust and we're still trying to figure out how we feel about so much, how we feel about it and how we're going to contribute to change it. Art often mirrors the world that we live in. How do you see creative expression shaping or reflecting the social attitudes and cultural tensions of our time?
To be honest, I have a bit of a pessimistic view on that, because I feel that as artists, it is our duty to be part of conversations regarding social activism or standing up for what we believe in through visual expression. And I found during our time that there have been a lot of disappointments where people have chosen fame, glory, financial gain in order to silence their true belief systems or to cushion certain ideologies. So I feel that you cannot truly be an artist, truly, truly represent yourself as an artist if you don't advocate and say with your chest exactly how you feel in every form of visual expression, every form. And I found there have been a lot of cowards when it comes to those types of discussions. I think there have been a lot of people that masquerade themselves as artists and social activists. And, you know, this is not to point the finger at artists that don't see themselves as that, because maybe they don't. I view art practice, first and foremost, the privilege of being able to articulate yourself in a visual way through tangible nodes, whether it's prose, poetry, research, paintings, whatever the case may be, to vocalize an understanding of self that is reflected out into the world. And so I've seen a lot of people that haven't done that with their creative practice. And I feel that, at least I can say for myself, it hasn't been easy. Really standing up for what you believe in is really, really difficult. And I don't want to get emotional about it, but people don't realize how difficult it is to really stand up for what you believe in. You don't know how many battles you have to fight. You don't know what happens behind the scenes. You don't know what people go through. And you can sit there and, you know, have a straight face and be like, you know, why are you doing this? It's like, you have to do it. Because if you don't, on the day of judgment, when you're standing in front of God, what are you going to answer to? What are you going to say to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? And I don't want to be a person that sits there and goes, wow, I had the privilege of being able to be an artist and a practitioner and to fight for things that I believed in. And I stood for nothing. So I fell for everything. And I had no backbone and I had no spine and I had no, I didn't use the gift of my ability to be able to articulate myself and the way that I carry myself and the language that I use and the lexicon that I've been able to like throw out there into the world to my advantage to advocate for something that I truly believe in. And so, yes, art is used as a vehicle for creating micro acts for resistance. And I think that when we relate it to a postscript that Giles Deleuze wrote many, many years ago, he spoke about everything in society. And the one thing that he didn't talk about was art practice. And why was that? Because it's the one thing you can't control. Mm. And I think that to be in a position, to have a privilege to stand for something and to say it in a very smart and sophisticated and intellectualized way, but you know people who know, like those who know and those who don't, you can rest your head on the pillow at night and know that I did something worth advocating for. And I fought for something that I believed in. And that's it.
Sarah, with initiatives like the Letters Project and the Native Informant, you've created platforms that document and critique our time, mm-hmm. both of which I truly appreciate, because I also feel like one of the things we didn't do the best job in is truly documenting not just our history, but critical moments in our history that could have changed the course of where we are today. What role do these spaces play in shaping how we understand critical identity and social change? Because I know that there has been a bit of a... there are a lot of people that have an issue with both platforms for different reasons. But I do think that both of them have a significant role to play.
Okay, well, just to clarify for people, I mean, the Letters Project is no longer operating mm-hmm. and it was, you know, it stood the test of time for 7 years and it couldn't go any further than that. But the Letters Project and the Native Informant are both extensions of the thesis statement that I spoke to you about, this overarching idea of who are we as Arabs? How can we recenter the conversation around Arab Muslim identity? And how can we shift perspectives and narratives that don't belong to us and have people advocate and feel like their voices matter, whether they belong to marginalized group, whether they feel like there's a form of underrepresentation? And so the Letters Project was a chance for people to really know what was happening on the ground, what people were thinking about, what people were feeling, And funnily enough, a friend of mine was like, this is literally a socio-anthropological and socio-cultural case study. Mm. And it lasted for 7 years and it ran its run. And a lot of the times, and it's not even to toot my own horn, but I feel like whenever I have conversations with people about things, they're like, Sarah, I think the things that you do are just ahead of their time. Like, people are just not ready for these types of conversations. And yeah, that might be right. Maybe they aren't. But, you know, at least we tried. At least we tried. And mm-hmm. I hope that in the future, when we kind of reintroduce the Letters Project, because I don't know, maybe someone might decide to do that, it'll be a more refined iteration of what it was. And mm-hmm. it will use the learnings and the teachings of what it went through for whoever wants to take it on. But I always say to those who follow, whether it was the Letters Project or the Native Informant, is that I am not part of that discourse. I am literally just the vehicle.
Platforming it.
That's all I'm doing. I don't make the stories. I don't have those narratives. I'm just facilitating. I am a facilitator of those spaces. And even, I mean, very little now is kind of branching out with the Native Informant. But a lot of the times it's other people's stories and just kind of giving that platform. Because what are we if not for social discourse? Mm-hmm. What are we if not for conversations surrounding who we are as people? So I'm just hoping that those platforms, to answer your questions, do advocate for social change, but in a way that we are a bit more open and honest about the way that we feel towards things. Mm. And that if you have a person or an experience that doesn't align with you ideologically or spiritually or culturally, that you can give space for those ideas to exist. You don't have to take them on. You don't have to believe them, but you don't have the right to shut them down or to cancel them or to write them off because they just don't align with you. And so, you know, with the Letters Project, I had conversations that were very pro-feminist and I had conversations that were very anti-feminist. I had conversations that were on the spectrum of racism that were for or against. And I know that that's a weird thing to think about, but it's like, the Letters Project was non-conforming. It allowed, there were so many letters that I had seen that I vehemently disagreed with, like with every fiber of my being. I was like, I don't agree with this ideologically. This doesn't align with my principles. But you know what? It's a space for people to express themselves. Mm. And to have that conversation, maybe, just maybe, we'll be able to find a common ground, which was what the comment sections provided.
Cancel culture is a polarizing topic today. And you've experienced it firsthand. How would you define it? And what do you think it means for the way that we hold people accountable in the world today?
I think cancel culture has shifted in terms of its definition. I think cancel culture in the West is very different to cancel culture here. I think even cancel culture in America is very different to what it is in the UK. I think that cancel culture, to my definition, is eliminating or not allowing the ability for growth, because I prefer the culture of redemption mm. rather than the culture of cancel. Mm. And because I look at it through the lens of my religion, which is something that I'm very proud of. I'm a proud Muslim. And if the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam could be forgiving, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the most forgiving, who am I to not forgive someone's sins or someone's indiscretions or someone's experience? That's not for me to judge. I cannot play both judge and jury. I cannot allow for the court of public opinion to have such a profound effect on the way that we understand people, because they only get the frontal veneer of what is actually happening. No one understands what happens behind closed doors. People don't know that with the Letters Project, what was happening behind the scenes was people helping people with court cases, people having conversations with the police and having them help out. People were having, you know, chances to raise funds for certain people that were struggling, or providing food or shelter for those who were struggling. This is all happening behind the scenes. And people don't realize that. They just see the story for its shock value or for its highbrow nature. And they don't realize that there were people that were saved behind the scenes. There were battles that were won. And I think that, you know, that was something that people didn't have to know because that was not part of the narrative. Like, we're not there for the clout or for the validation or for, you know, the clickbait or whatever. If you only knew half of the stories that happened behind the scenes of the Letters Project, it would make you cry. It would make you cry what was happening behind the scenes. And, but we were helping. We were helping people. And I think as well, you know, with places like the Native Informant, conversations sometimes people disagree with, like in the comments section. Mm. I mean, if we talk about conversations regarding like Gaza, you're bound to find a Zionist in the comment section. It's going to happen, you know? Mm. And I think that it's important to at least facilitate that collectively we're stronger. Mm. So when you talk about cancel culture, you're talking about abandoning collectivism because you're talking about the individual. You're going to ice out the individual. And you're going to shun them and, you know, disrespect them and belittle them and shame them and all of these things. But yet you stand on your high horse thinking that you're so perfect. So I think that cancel culture should no longer be the culture of cancel. It should be the culture of redemption. Mm-hmm. That's my personal view.
There's so much that I agree with because you're using it in the context of the individual. But, you know, as a Palestinian, half Palestinian and half Lebanese, seeing what's happening in both my countries, I wonder if cancel culture does have a role to play in terms of being a productive force for social justice in the larger scheme of things. So I love the way you framed it around redemption because it very much echoes how I feel in relationship, especially to my religion. I'm also a proud Muslim, alhamdulillah. But yeah, I feel like there's definitely a bigger conversation to be had around it if we're going to look at it on that macro level.
Mm-hmm. You know what's interesting, and I know this is completely sort of off topic, but I remember when I was living in the UK, I was talking about things to do with religion, and one of the tutors, like the professors that I was part of when I was doing my postgraduate, like a master's degree, he said, he just laughed when I was talking about things that were very rooted in religion, which funnily enough, a lot of people in the West who aren't rooted in religion wouldn't kind of understand it. And he said, he was like, Sarah, don't you know we're living in a godless time? And I thought to myself, that's really interesting and really rich coming from somebody who doesn't want to operate from a place of forgiveness, a place of tolerance, a place of acceptance, a place of, just forgiveness in general. And I remember it was at a time during like Brexit. And so there was a lot of animosity and anger towards people who were othered in the UK. But to kind of go back to what you were saying, I think what the West is trying to do, and I hope they're not successful in it, is trying to push us away from our core values and norms and belief systems, mainly our understanding towards religion, and that then we can shift our understanding towards cultures that are rooted in cancellation rather than redemption, so that we can advocate for this idea like, okay, at the end of the day, the way that we should say it as Arabs is like, Allah bihasbik bi akhir zaman. You know, so it's like, whatever you choose to do, that's fine. And so we can't be upset with people. Like, even when we talk about people who are dealing with, you know, what's happening in the Levant, just in general, is like, you have to be okay with this idea that going, Allah bihasbun bi akhir zaman, like, it's not in our hands. We can do everything that we can, but when they stand in front of God on judgment day, that's their bone to pick, you know? So that's at least what gives me, from a perspective of trying to like regulate my nervous system is that it's all in God's hands. This is all happening the way that it needs to. And everything, all the martyrs that have suffered are all in a good place and they are not suffering anymore. And that we are not bound by the dunya, it's about the akhirah, and so they are there, so it's fine. So that those are the things that are keeping me sort of sane at night, because it is, this emotional dysregulation is
a lot,
crippling.
Sarah, if you could speak to a version of yourself who's still finding her path, what would you tell her to help navigate the complexities of identity and belonging, especially knowing what you know now?
Of course, you have to ask that question. What would I say to my younger self or a version of myself? You're going to be okay. I think that. I think I know that I am the version of the person that I wish I had when I was younger. And I know that I am a person that is rooted in love and compassion and empathy, and I listen and I love so deeply with every fiber of my being, but I no longer will succumb to people taking advantage of it and painting me in a light I don't exist. And the people that are out there that have done that for years, I'm not talking about people who have done this for like a day and then they get over it and they move on. I'm talking about people who have systematically targeted me and caused a lot of heartache and stress behind the scenes. Allah bi hasbun bi akhir zaman. I know what I did, and I came from a place of authenticity and genuine rapport. For them, I just wish them well and I send them love and light. And I know that the younger version of Sarah, whatever you want to say, would be proud.
You're an incredible woman. And I hope you know that. And I'm not just saying that out of the kindness of my heart. What I find so beautiful about your ability to be vulnerable today is everything that you said, truly, Sarah, is something that I've always known about you. You haven't changed into this person. This has always been you.
Thank you, Donna.
And I'm so proud of you.
Oh, thanks. Oh, I hate getting emotional on podcasts, but
why? I'm all about embracing vulnerability. It's honestly in a world that is so difficult to navigate and survive in, this has been my saving grace. Cry. Remind the world that you are human in the face of all of those that are not. Thank you. Thank you for your vulnerability.
Thank you. And I truly believe that every time I hear the saying, if not now, then when? And if not us, then who? Is something that I really, really live by. And I think that when I have been the person that has been on the chopping block for so long, I refuse to be a victim. And so when I show vulnerability, I see it as an opportunity to open up another place for someone to come in and try and dig their claws in. Mm-hmm. Because we've all suffered, whether it's in life, with relationships, with friends, with family, with loss, with grief, with so many different things. But for me, I have to remain strong because I have to be the person that I wish I was when I was younger. And you said it, like, yes, I've always been this way, but I think now I break less. And if I do cry, I cry in the comfort of my own home, because there is somebody out there that needs somebody to stand up and advocate for something. And if I can just provide a little glimmer of hope that they can feel empowered to do something about it, then so be it. I've done what I've needed to do. I feel that even when I do things, like whether it's the Lattice Project, whether it's the Native Informant, whether it's researching Half Emiratis, whether it's trying to do things, the people that complain the most and the people that have issues with it the most are those who are just like me, but they just don't, for whatever reason, have the ability to do it themselves. So they need the sacrificial lamb. They need to have that person that paves the way so that they can walk in and glide in so easily. And the thing is, they think that I hate that, but no, I accept that. I accept this as fate. Like, this is what's meant to happen. But yeah, I just thank you for saying what you said. I really appreciate it.
I meant it.
Thank you.
You've given us a lot to consider, Sarah. And I'm very grateful for that. I knew you would. I want to end this episode on a final question, one that I usually ask all my guests. What would you want to ask me? What would you like me to consider based on this conversation?
I think you and I have had loads of conversations outside of this podcast that that have to do with life, identity, religion, you know, our position as women who are single, trying to navigate this world. Do you consider the possibility that there is hope for whatever the future is going to bring, whether it's hope for the region, whether it's hope for our people, whether it's the hope for finding a partner, where do you stand with that?
That's a powerful question. But the answer is easy. All I see is hope. It's the lifeline that I live by. And I say that in the context of the life that I'm living and the partnership I do hope to have one day in my life and the family I hope to have one day. But I also see that in the context of the difficulties that we're having to witness. We're in an age of evolution in so many ways. And it's really hard. Change is incredibly hard. And there's a lot of sacrifice in it. But if anything, if I've learned anything from the people that are suffering the most around us, it is that we can't not be hopeful. We would be doing life, this dunya, a disservice if we were not hopeful, because that is the lifeline for survival. To have faith in this idea that a better tomorrow is possible is the only thing that gets me through whatever it is that I am trying to get through. And yeah, that's how I see it.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Sarah. Wow. Thank you so much for joining us today. I have such an admiration for you and what you stand for. And I'm so grateful for what you have done, because I do think that you have paved the way for so many people, not just women, so many people, to be brave enough to step outside their comfort zone, to step outside what society has imposed on them with the intent to change. So thank you. Thank you for everything that you have done. Thank you for not giving up. And thank you for being part of this conversation and giving us something to consider.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me.
To our listeners, I want to thank you as always for the privilege of your time. We're very keen to hear your feedback, so please do leave us your comments. I'd love to hear your feedback on the content of the show, so please do leave us your comments below. Also, please do subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to it. Any and all support is always appreciated. In the meantime, I hope you found something to consider.